From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We'll hear from two Broadway songwriters on this holiday edition of Fresh Air. How About You, Old Devil Moon, On a Clear Day You Can See Forever are just a few of the songs composed by Burton Lane. Coming up, Burton Lane tells us about the songs he's written and the lyricists he wrote them with. Also, we hear from composer Charles Strauss. His musicals include Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, Golden Boy, and Annie. If your parents ever forced you to play piano in front of their friends or your relatives, you'll appreciate what Lane and Strauss were made to do, except both of them went on to fabulous songwriting careers. How about you? First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A published report says Whitewater Special Counsel Kenneth Starr is expected to seek indictments against several people in the real estate deal linked to President and Mrs. Clinton. The Los Angeles Times says there's no indication Starr is considering bringing indictments against the President or the First Lady. But the Times says he is reportedly preparing charges against Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker and former U.S. Associate Attorney General, Webster Hubbell. Many restaurants and catering services are gearing up for the holiday shopping rush. The industry did a survey in 1990 that found 10% of Americans eat out on Thanksgiving. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
The National Restaurant Association says 50% of meals purchased outside the home are for carryout, and Thanksgiving is no exception. Cincinnati-based Kroger grocery chain sells complete dinners from turkey and stuffing to mashed potatoes and pumpkin pies. Spokesman Paul Burnish.
Started offering completely cooked turkey dinners in the holidays about 7 years ago, and the growth has been nothing short of phenomenal. Last year, company-wide, we sold nearly 94,000 complete dinners, and we're expecting to surpass that this year.
Burnish suspects many people don't know how to cook a turkey. He says Kroger's 800 customer service line gets lots of panicky calls this time of year. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
A group of 29 East Timorese students who'd occupied the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, Indonesia, have left. They're traveling to Portugal, where they've been granted political asylum. The BBC's Catherine Napier reports.
The 29 protesters were bussed out of the embassy compound in a white Red Cross vehicle as dusk fell, looking tired and dejected. Around 200 journalists and onlookers were waiting outside, but the Timorese made no attempt to motion to the crowd. When they arrived at the airport, the group boarded a flight to Amsterdam. They're due to travel on to Lisbon on Friday. The government continues to insist that the majority of Timorese support integration, but recent anti-Indonesian protests in East Timor itself have severely weakened its case. In the latest incident on Thursday, police fired tear gas to break up a crowd of angry students in the capital, Dili. The confrontation came after the students claimed their university campus had been infiltrated by plainclothes security officials.
Catherine Napier reporting. NATO allies are disagreeing on how best to deal with the Bosnian Serbs. NATO's concluded an emergency session on the Bosnian War. Ambassadors say they will launch more airstrikes against the Serbs if they continue their attacks on Bihać in northwestern Bosnia. But NATO ambassadors will not support a U.S. plan to protect the safe haven even more. The safe haven support would expand the zone. This is NPR. The Palestinian Authority and Islamic militants have reached a temporary truce. Palestinian mediators announced an agreement late yesterday. This comes almost a week after Palestinian police opened fire on Islamic rioters, killing 14 and wounding 150 in Gaza City. The truce calls for both sides to refrain from violence until they can clinch a permanent understanding. Only police will now be allowed to carry weapons in the streets. Neither side will print propaganda leaflets or hold rallies without the authorities' permission. Palestinian officials say leaders from both sides will issue a statement today saying the new agreement will prevent a civil war. The Japanese government says it's considering sending personal letters of apology to the women who were forced to act as sex slaves for Japanese soldiers during World War II. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The clamor over Japan's handling of the women conscripted into sexual service has grown louder over the past 24 hours. In Tokyo, several survivors staged a symbolic one-day hunger strike. In Seoul, scores of protesters on behalf of the estimated 200,000 Asian women forced to perform sex scuffled with police outside the Japanese embassy. Reports that Japan's government is now considering a letter of apology to each victim bearing the prime minister's name is the latest attempt to calm the furor that was reignited this week by an internationally renowned group of lawyers. In a lengthy report, they labeled Japan's wartime policy a war crime and said each woman was entitled to an immediate cash payment of $40,000. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The man who seized a Russian airliner has surrendered. Officials in Estonia say the hijacker gave up after releasing all 70 people aboard the plane. He'd commandeered it over northern Russia and forced it to fly to Estonia. He had demanded to be taken on to Denmark. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Happy Thanksgiving. This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. The songs How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, and You're My Thrill, were written by my guest Burton Lane. Many of his songs were composed for movies, but he wrote some of his best-known melodies for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He's collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. I spoke with Burton Lane in 1990 when he was 77. He had just teamed up with singer Michael Feinstein to record the first volume of the Burton Lane Songbook. Since then, they've put out a second recording of Lane's songs. What makes these recordings special is that Lane himself is at the piano, accompanying Feinstein. The first volume opens with a song that Lane wrote with lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane at the piano. We'll hear the verse from that original recording, then segue into the recent recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls are falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work we never shirk, in a happy land of tinsel and gauze. Because we like applause.
Burton Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I was received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you two names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old, and this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engage in some trifling, just very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, "Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative." Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, "I had to take one too."
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, "Bert, play," and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, "I'll do it if you sit alongside of me." So he was sitting facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, "Is this your son?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "My name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back." And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for a Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remick's music publishing company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remick's, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, French Artaud. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
The song that was used for that movie, well, one of the songs that was used for that movie was "Everything I Have Is Yours."
That's right.
Beautiful song. And who in the movie sang it?
It was sung by Arthur Jarrett, who was the current big singer, such as Bing Crosby was at that time. He had his own radio show, and he was the one who sang the song. And the song, everybody knows, "Everything I Have Is Yours, You're Part of Me." I got a call one day, shortly after the song was purchased, and I was asked if I could think of something for Joan Crawford to do in the song, because she was dancing with Clark Gable by the bandstand, and as she danced by, they wanted her to have something to sing. And I thought of a little phrase, da-da-da, da-da-da-da, which she hummed, and that became part of the song. And all the orchestrations that came out at that time, going back 1933, had that little phrase that she hummed in the picture.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show on the bill. Were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs. Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody, which had been done by many people in vaudeville, called Airly Airly. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl. And he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her, which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week. And she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition, and the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening, because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out. And some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years, and in 1941 was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You.
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein. And there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralph Fiedler wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus. And it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I recorded on the record. And I think it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it?
Thank you.
composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You. You know, I, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listening, the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, how about you? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Reed. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
My guest is composer Burton Lane. He wrote the score for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. I spoke with him in 1990 after the recording Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook was released. More with Burton Lane after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Burton Lane is my guest. You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Harburg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love, I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, I would sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. But most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Did this new record with Michael Feinstein bring you out of retirement?
I've never retired.
I wasn't sure about that.
Well, I'm sure. I've never stopped writing. I've always kept writing, and I think it's important. I remember once during the Depression when things were rough, or actually it was a recession in Hollywood, and it was so discouraging to sit down and write because I couldn't get a job. And I remember when I finally did get one, it was very difficult to start the creative juices flowing, and I think it's just like an athlete. You must keep in shape. And so when I've learned that lesson, I've never stopped writing. In fact, on the album, there are a couple of new songs, and I'm very proud of those songs.
Was there a period where you felt that Broadway or musical movies had changed sufficiently so as to kind of leave you out?
No, I don't think so. One of my problems has been finding a lyric writer that I could really team up with. I remember many times I tried to convince Yip Harburg that when you're a team, you grow together, you have a continuity of work together, and I think that's important. All one has to do is look at the careers of Richard Rodgers, who had a long career with Larry Hart, and then when that broke up and Larry died, he had Oscar Hammerstein. And it was after Oscar died that Dick was in the same situation that most of us are in who don't have a team. He wrote with many writers, never really found a mate, so to speak. So that's one of the problems that I personally have, is not having a steady lyric writer.
But you'd like to have one if you could.
Oh, yes, I would, sure.
I should ask you before we wrap up, how did this collaboration between you and Michael Feinstein happen?
Well, it was Michael's idea. He came to me with this idea. We have been friends. Actually, I knew that Michael had worked for Ira Gershwin, but I never had a chance to meet him until there was a memorial service for Ira in New York, and Michael was there, and I met him that day, and we became friends. And when he would come into New York, we'd meet and spend a couple of hours together around a piano. He would sing, I would play, and it was Michael's idea that I join him in an album. And I said, well, Michael, you know, you do so well for yourself when you're playing. Why do you need me? He said, well, this is what I'd like to do. And that's how it happened.
Is this album changing your life in any way?
I think it's on the verge of changing it. I appeared at the Golden Theater on three occasions. Michael had asked me to do this. And the reaction of the audience was so overwhelming that it kind of shook me up. One of the things I realize is that when we write songs that people like, that those songs are making friends for us, and we as the writers don't know who these people are until we appear before them. And it was just an amazing experience.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I also want to thank you for writing so many great songs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Songwriter Burton Lane, recorded in 1990. He still occasionally performs. He did a benefit with Michael Feinstein last week. A touring production of his musical Finian's Rainbow is being assembled and is expected to go on the road next year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more from Volume 2 of Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook with Burton Lane at the piano.
Not that I'm a punchinello, just an optimistic fellow with a lot of very mellow music in my soul. Not that I'm a Pollyanna, shouting out a loud Hosanna. It's my singing heart I can't control. I hear music, mighty fine music, the murmur of a morning breeze up there, the rattle of the milkman on the stair. Sure, that's music, mighty fine music, the singing of a sparrow in the sky, the perking of the coffee right nearby. There's my favorite melody, you my angel, phoning me. Mighty fine music, and anytime I think my world is wrong, I get me out of bed and sing this song.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. composer Charles Strauss thought he was heading for a career of serious classical music. Then he got the proverbial phone call, which led to his first Broadway hit, Bye Bye Birdie. And it's been 17 years since his mega hit Annie opened on Broadway, featuring one of his most famous songs, Tomorrow. How many kids have sung that one at a talent show? Charles Strauss coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A published report says Whitewater Special Counsel Kenneth Starr will soon seek indictments against people in the real estate deal linked to President and Mrs. Clinton. The Los Angeles Times says there's no indication Starr is thinking about seeking indictments for the President and the First Lady. Meanwhile, a federal judge has agreed to delay sentencing for a person in the Whitewater case. The judge granted the delay in the case of David Hale, a former Arkansas municipal judge. Hale has accused then-Governor Bill Clinton of pressuring him into making a $300,000 loan. The federally backed loan was for Susan McDougal, whose husband owned Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan. Madison has been linked to the Clintons' Whitewater land deal. Supporters of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade say they believe they have enough votes to pass the World Trade Agreement. But opponents of the trade pact say they aren't giving up so easily. UPI's Howard Dykus prepared this report.
Senator Pat Moynihan says flatly he now has the votes to get Senate agreement to the GATT treaty that will set up an international court to settle trade disputes between countries. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole has decided to support it, even though he gets 2,000 calls a day opposing it. President Clinton supports it too, and so does Rush Limbaugh. But it's opposed by Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan. The House plans to vote Tuesday, the Senate on Thursday. Howard Dykus, Washington.
Authorities in Cincinnati report an outbreak of hepatitis A has reached epidemic proportions. Marianne Zalesnik of member station WNKU has this report.
The worst of the outbreak is in northern Kentucky. At least 34 cases of hepatitis A have been confirmed, with about a dozen more in Cincinnati. Health officials say that number may still go up. It's the worst outbreak in the area in 7 years. The source of the hepatitis is a Covington Cafe and Catering Company. An employee with the disease worked handling food for 2 weeks before it was diagnosed. The service catered at least 20 events in the greater Cincinnati area during that time. Hepatitis causes a liver infection that produces flu-like symptoms. Eating food contaminated by people who don't properly wash their hands after using the bathroom can transmit the virus. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
Senate Republican leader Bob Dole says he does not see any problems with Jesse Helms taking over the Foreign Relations Committee. The North Carolina Republican has said that President Clinton should take a bodyguard with him when he visits North Carolina. Some Democrats charge that comments like that show that Mr. Helms is not fit to lead the Foreign Relations Panel. However, Dole has told CNN Helms assures him such comments won't happen again. Helms insists the comments were not to be taken literally. Dole says they probably shouldn't have been made in jest. This is NPR. Hungarians are recovering from a contamination scandal involving the spice paprika, which gives Hungarian goulash and other dishes their distinctive bite. Sales were banned for 3 weeks in September after consumers began to get sick from lead poisoning, and supplies of paprika were found to have been treated with lead oxide to improve their red color. Mariel Beatty reports for the BBC.
Powdered paprika is on sale again, a fact welcomed by Hungarians who are reputed to eat an average half kilo of the red-hot powder each year. But the spice is now subject to strict quality controls, a move which has devastated the small armies of market gardeners who used to sell it at roadside stalls and weekend markets. Foreign sales have also been hit. When news of the scandal first broke, Hungarian trade officials were quick to stress that the paprika grown for export, about 5,000 tons each year, was always strictly controlled and therefore uncontaminated. But even so, the country's main exporters now say that many foreign clients have simply lost their taste for paprika. One company in the southern city of Szeged estimates that the scandal will mean a loss of 25% in its annual sales abroad.
Mariel Beattie reporting. A legal challenge has been filed against Oregon's new assisted suicide law. A group of doctors and patients filed a lawsuit yesterday. They charged the law is unconstitutional and will pressure the sick to end their lives. Voters narrowly approved the measure earlier this month. It would let doctors, under certain conditions, prescribe lethal drugs to patients who have less than 6 months to live. The Postal Service has reversed itself. The service says it will issue a Madonna and Child Christmas stamp next year after all. Last week, the service announced plans for new stamps but left out the popular Madonna stamp, which has been an annual feature for years. Officials changed their minds after getting complaints from stamp collectors and from the White House. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm sure you know some of the songs written by my guest Charles Strauss. Put on a Happy Face, I've Got a Lot of Livin' to Do, and Kids are just some of the songs from his very first Broadway show, Bye Bye Birdie. He also wrote the music for Golden Boy, Applause, and the mega hit Annie. Before his Broadway career, he studied classical music with Aaron Copland and Nadia Boulanger. I spoke with Strauss about a year ago during the off-Broadway run of his Annie sequel called Annie Warbucks. Let's hear Catherine Zaremba as Annie from the original cast recording of Annie Warbucks.
Every other Christmas, I got nothing. But this Christmas, 1933, I got everything, even a new name. I'm Annie Warbucks. Trouble kept banging at my door. Beat it, trouble.
This music from Annie Warbucks, Charles Strauss's latest musical. Charles Strauss, welcome to Fresh Air. When you wrote the songs for Annie and now for Annie Warbucks, did you have to write in a range that you were confident a kid could sing?
Well, that's really an interesting question because yes and no. The yes is a part of my musical background. I know what kids' ranges and sopranos and tenors are. The no part is that I wanted to squeeze a little bit more out of them because the emotional part of the music is when kids sing high, they scream. You know, I did it in Bye Bye Birdie, and in Bye Bye Birdie, they sang notes in the telephone hour that they didn't think they could sing. And actually, I had learned a lot of that. I used to work for Frank Lesser. I was his assistant for 2 years. And I remember when Frank was testing people for range, he would often have them sing
from Bushel and a Peck.
From Bushel and a Peck. And because it was, he would put it in a key with the pianist that it would be out of their range. They had to go. But because they were making fun, they could or could not hit it. Had you said, sing that note legitimately in a song like, I don't know, If I Loved You or something, they would have said they can't reach it. But when they were playing these characters, they could. So I devised, it's not my own invention, but or maybe it is, I don't know, these kids would come in and I would just have them sing Happy Birthday. Once they passed the other thing, I would have them sing a song that they didn't have to worry about anything. And so they would, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. See, and very often they found that they could reach notes which on their resumes they couldn't reach at all, and that was the sound I wanted. So I did write for that, and particularly in a song like Hard Knock Life and in Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow. And what happened was that at the very beginning, during our auditions, nobody could sing these songs. Today, every girl in the world sings them, which is, it's a wonderful, actually, tribute to the psychology and any popularity the songs have.
Let me move to the first show that you did that was a real hit, one of the Broadway classics, and that's Bye Bye Birdie. Now, I had to tell you, I was listening to the album again last night, and I hadn't heard the score in a long time, and I was just shocked to realize that I remembered words to songs when I'd completely forgotten the song existed, like Normal American Boy. I mean, I haven't thought about that song in years, and I realized, God, I know all the words to this. And I bet so many people have that reaction when they hear songs from Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, fortunately they do. It's a very, very much performed show. At the time, Lee Adams and Mike Stewart and I wrote it. We wrote it because it was offered us, you might say. We would have written, I guess, almost any show that was offered us. It actually wasn't even in that shape. It was just to be a show about teenagers. But had we realized that it would have that kind of commercial clout, that is, that high schools and camps and prisons, I don't know, everybody does it. It's incredible. And it keeps picking up in performances. I think we would have said, oh, let's do that show. But at the time, it was just, it was actually even a little strange. It was a bit of an embarrassment in a funny way to me and to Mike, because, well, to me particularly, because I had I'd been in serious music all my life. I'd studied classical music. I was embarking on a serious music career, that this would be the first opportunity that I'd have for a major public hearing, and then that we had this silly name, Bye Bye Birdie. It was not the show that I wanted to write, which taught me something about myself, which is I don't know where the hell I am half the time.
Let me ask you about writing the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie. And this is a series of phone conversations that the teenagers are having with each other. And it's not a straightforward song. I mean, you're basically setting a series of conversations to music with little interruptions and phones right. ringing. So what were some of your considerations when you were writing the music for that?
Well, you know, before I just answer that, I have four kids, and it's come back to haunt me because I have four telephone lines, and it's still every second everybody's on the phone. Anyway, beside the point, my considerations were, first of all, that it was rock, and of its sort, it is rock music, though such an innocent sort that, you know, I don't like to listen to it and say I'm Mick Jagger or anybody like that. But it was rock, and I paid attention very strongly to the guitar chords, you know, that the all guitarists play on it. You know, a lot of rock music in those days particularly was very, I don't want to say simple, because that wouldn't, that would be a little bit derogatory, but it there were certain patterns. It became patterned in a way, and I did model it on that. But then I used a lot of... I used a lot of changes of time and a lot of interjections, which is into the exact rock beat. But I kept the beat going very much, and then I used Lee and I sat and kind of carved it out together, high and you know the things. Did they really get pinned?
Well, here's the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie, music by my guest Charles Stouse.
Harvey Johnson, can I speak to Penelope Ann?
You know about Kim?
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom?
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
Did they really get killed?
Go and get it!
She saw him!
Go and get it!
She saw him!
Go and get it!
She nailed it!
Anybody?
Music from Bye Bye Birdie. My guest is composer Charles Strauss. He wrote the music for Bye Bye Birdie, Golden Boy, Applause, Annie, and now Annie Warbucks. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer Charles Strauss. You studied with Nadia Boulanger. Did she give you any advice about pop music versus classical music?
Well, oddly enough, she did. This woman was the great musician of our generation in many ways, and her greatness was that she was a master analyst, not only of music but a psychoanalyst in her own way. And she used to hear the music of her students, and she was able to isolate it. She was able to shine a spotlight on what was you, and what was watered down Stravinsky. I remember when I worked with her, she asked to hear everything I'd written, and I played her my sonata and my concerto and various things, art songs and all that. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, that's it. She said, well, no, what about, you know, your student pieces? And I played her some of them. And then anything else? And I said, well, there was my parents, who were never into serious music at all, though they were very proud of me. I used to come home from college and play them all these pieces that sounded like watered down Bartok, really, but it was a very serious kind of things. I was really, you know, into it, and I could see they were proud of me, but they didn't really
respond.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think so. My mother was just always so nervous for me. But I remember writing a piece that I considered my party piece that I could play that they could show off to my aunt. I had an aunt Stella, who was hard of hearing to begin with, but it was she was over at the house a lot, and I wrote this piece, and it was really, you know, I look back at it today, kind of saucy or something. It was very lighthearted, and everybody liked it. So it became my piece, and I played that for her, which I very rarely, I didn't do that for anybody except, you know, a couple of relatives. And she said, well, what else? And I said, when my brother, he had been in the Navy, and when he came home from his first tour of duty, or his boot camp, whatever, I had written I laugh because it was a funny moment in my life. And I said, I wrote this little song for him called Welcome Home, Able-Bodied Seaman Strauss. See? And she said, may I hear that? Oh, I said, I could. No, she said, please. And so there, with this venerable woman, I played this silly song. She said, I see. She said, anything else? And I said, this makes me laugh. I said, I used to go out with a girl. I really liked her. Her name was Janet. And we lived on the Upper West Side of New York. And I wrote this song, but it was a joke called Moon Over 83rd Street. She said, play this for me. Here I am in Paris, you know, with an intimate of Stravinsky's and every American composer that you could think of having studied with this great woman. So I played Moon Over 83rd Street. And she said, good. Now we go back to this, whatever. So we went back to... towards the end of my thing, she said to me something that nobody had ever said to me. She said that you have a great talent for light music.
May I make a request?
Sure.
Could you sing one of the songs that you played for her?
Wait a second. The Welcome Home, Able Bunny Seaman Strauss. You're right. No, I can't sing that one. Moon Over It. Oh, Moon This is the funniest interview I've ever done. Moon Over 83rd Street with with shafts right below, a moon over 83rd Street, my heart's all aglow. You, Janet, in the lamplight, I hear something call. I hear something dull. I'm yours, body and soul. I think that was the last one. It was meant partly as a jest. I mean, but that was it. There's a first performance for you.
So, but it helped you. It helped you find out that that's what you should be doing. Is writing pop tunes.
That was her genius. That's why I can laugh at it. I can also laugh at it because I've had some successful shows. But her genius was really taking a young kid like me. I was quite young when I was there. I was around 18 or so, and I know from my own experience with my own children what it is to be searching for an identity. And she, in her soft, brilliant way, was able to contribute to my identifying who I was.
My guest is composer Charles Strauss. Back in a minute. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio's All Things Considered in Washington. On our program coming up, Linda Gradstein reports from Israel. A Palestinian has been sentenced to death for his part in a suicide bus bombing last April. We'll have letters from listeners. Among the subjects, Senator Jesse Helms, and our recent story about sound memories. Bailey White from Tallahassee has a special Thanksgiving story for us about family. I'll talk with a woman from Arlington, Texas, about her Thanksgiving Day being spent at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And a musical conversation, we'll talk with Ann Hills and Cindy Mangson about harmony singing in their new album, Never Grow Old. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Back with composer Charles Strauss. He wrote the songs for the musicals Bye Bye Birdie, Golden Boy, Applause, and Annie. I want to close with the story behind one of your most famous songs, and this is the song from Annie, Tomorrow. Tell us about writing the song, what you intended when you wrote it, and the song has really taken on a life of its own. The song seems to alternate between major and minor keys, no?
Yes, it does. It's there are a number of feelings I have about the song. The first one always had been and still stays with me. I feel somebody, a trooper is going to knock on my door and say, all right, come with us, you're under arrest, because it's the one song in the show, the one song of a personal nature in the show that could not have been written in the 30s. I could say the same perhaps for Hard Knock Life, but Hard Knock Life was a bit of dramatic music where I was kind of outside it in a way. But here's a song of a girl during the Depression, and this song is definitely could only have been written in the 70s, the harmonies and the kind of melodic. So I thought, if nothing else, I mean, I didn't think the show was going to be successful, but I certainly felt as though critics were going to say, now wait a second, how could they write this? Everything else was, we'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, and I don't need anything but you. It kind of, I don't like the word pastiche because I filter it, I hope, through my own intelligence, but they were kind of pastiches, using Harry Warren and Cole Porter and those kind of Gershwin composers as my, as the filter, so to speak. But that song, no, and it was just out of another era completely. So that was my first thing about it. The second thing about it was that nobody could sing it because it was so rangy.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing about it, which is it's just curious. I've worked with a number of collaborators, though I've worked mostly with Lee Adams, but I've done a show with Sammy Kahn, with Alan J. Lerner, with Richard Maltby. I mean, there have just been a lot of them, Stephen Schwartz in my life, though not those particularly, but all the collaborators along the way, I had this song and I played it for many of them, and they all said, yeah, no, okay, what else do you have? Martin and I were looking for a song of hope at that moment, and I played him. Actually, it wasn't a whole song. I had written it for a movie, this theme, for an industrial film that I did, and I always liked the theme, and Martin picked up on it, and I had no idea. I certainly didn't think it was going to be a big success. I did think that it got an awfully big hand in the theater when Andrea sang it, but I thought it was the set. Martin had made a nice move with the set that had changed. She went behind, and then she wasn't there. So I always thought, gee, they're applauding. That's set.
So this is a trunk song that every lyricist you work with rejected, and it finally went
on
point, to be a big success.
At that point, every lyricist, yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear it, and let me say it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's great.
Composer Charles Strauss recorded last year. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross. Happy Thanksgiving.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Lauren Bacall reflects on acting, her marriage to Humphrey Bogart, and her life now as an older single woman. And Stephen Schiff reviews Junior, the new Arnold Schwarzenegger-Danny DeVito film. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.